Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Joanne Dahlketter with Performing Edge Coaching International, and it is September 25th, 2014, my birthday, and so we're having a birthday call, so to speak, and I'm in out of town in Santa Barbara, so I'm on my cell phone today, so if the cell phone reception is a little in and out, you'll know that it's just the cell phone, and hopefully we'll do the best we can with the reception here. Hopefully it'll hang in there okay. So today, yeah, we're going to talk about part three of our talk on competition and how to prepare your athletes for the best competition that they can do mentally and physically and emotionally. And so just wanted to, get all of your ideas as well from your experiences with your athletes. And share case studies and talk to about what to do the night, especially the night before the race or event, and the morning of, because those are really difficult times often for athletes to be able to manage their emotions. And so you often hear athletes say, "I can do it in training, but I can't do it in the event when it really counts." So that's what's key here, I think, and that's what can create a lot of business for you as performing edge coaches, and for all of us to be able to help athletes to get through those really tough times and to be able to have that same kind of relaxed mindset that they have in practice that they do in that they can have in a competition as well. So, maybe just check in with everyone that's here. Alex, welcome, Alex.
Welcome.
Yeah. Are you there? And welcome, Dave.
Welcome. Glad to be here.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. I just wondered if you have, first of all, the main reason, of course, for these calls is to answer your questions, and just wondered if you had any questions about athletes, about this topic, or about anything that's coming up, or any success stories, anything that you're doing that you want to share?
I have more questions on the just business marketing end of things at the moment. So I could email you those or ask later. I'm not sure how much time
okay.
I want to take up time here.
Okay. Yeah, you could email me and then you can ask some maybe as we go along here too.
Okay.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah. Did someone else just join us? I just heard a ding.
Hi, Dr. Joanne. It's Michelle. Sorry I'm late.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah. Welcome, Michelle.
Happy birthday.
Yeah. Glad to have you here. Yeah, that's great. So I was just...
happy birthday to you. Hope you're having a good day.
Oh, happy birthday. Thank you for your birthday wishes. I really appreciate it. I was just saying I'm on my cell phone here in Santa Barbara for a birthday party down here today, so I was just if the reception goes in and out, it's just because of the cell phone here. But hopefully, can you hear me okay, Michelle?
Yep, no problem. Thanks.
Oh, good. All right, great. So, if you, Michelle, do you have any questions or anything you wanted to share?
No, I might be having an article published on Friday in the local newspaper.
Oh, great. Okay. What's
which
the topic?
Hopefully, which will generate me some business. Performance anxiety. It's
great.
Directed towards teens. That's kind of who I'm targeting here in Vancouver. And we have a community newspaper that sort of serves the whole North Shore. And, yeah, so I sent the article, and she said, love it. It's going to go in the sports section, and we'll either get in this weekend or next. So, yeah.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, congratulations. That's a great way to get business for sure.
Hopefully. One can only go up at this point.
Yeah, no, most newspapers are online now as well as print. So if you can make sure, ask them to put it on their online version as well. Maybe they do that automatically, but just try to do that. And then, always include a link to your website. Your link information about how people can get in touch with you. And, yeah, if you can offer something free, often with websites, too, it's good to you know, not just take them to a home page, but if you have a page where people can sign up for something or get a free report there, join your email list, then that really can help you to build your list as well and build interest in you. And or if you have a free coaching session or some way to that people can do a short consult with you phone, then you give a phone number or email where they can get in touch. That's a great way to get started with clients as well. So, yeah. So today in our call, we were going to talk about how to get your athletes prepared for competitions and sort of toolbox to help your athletes with top level events. We'll talk about what to do the night before your event, the morning of, the formula for getting athletes prepared, and some techniques for dealing with all the different possible scenarios that happen. Talking about athletes' current, you know, their current mental skills, assessing those, and then finding out how motivated your athletes are. And then, you know, talking about some ideas how to create a custom pre-event visualization MP3, not just a general one, but one that's really based on exactly what that athlete needs for their specific event. And then how to create those power words. You know, you can ask your athlete about their strengths, what they like about themselves, what they feel they're strong at, what makes them a good athlete, and then create a power words MP3 audio, you know, to fit their exact competitive circumstances and to bring out their strengths and reinforce those. And then, how to develop resilience. If, let's say, you've got oftentimes athletes that have difficulty bouncing back, or they've had a series of losses or not doing as well, you want to have them be able to have a way to bounce back, or in baseball they call it having a short memory, you know, for what just happened, so that you can bounce back. So you have your athletes imagine success rather than the failure that maybe they just had before that. And then dealing with all the different athlete situations that can come up. So one of the things that, you know, of course happens almost universally is nervousness and anxiety before events, and that's something that you want to help your athletes to, you know, harness that power from the nervous system, so you direct it toward their goals. And you know, so we have athletes that where the big event, let's say, is only a few days away, or the next day, and the whole season that they've been working toward boils down to this one event that's happening very soon. And oftentimes that's when you'll get a call from athletes wanting your help, and you can feel the pressure mounting, and you feel physically prepared, you know, the athlete does, but oftentimes they haven't taken the time to prepare their mind, so and how to react in different situations. And I think you can reassure your athletes that if they prepare mentally and physically, you know, as we're talking about on these calls and in our trainings here in the modules for the Performing Edge Coach training modules, I think you can reassure athletes that they won't have to worry as much about pressure, because they can actually, you want to help them to prepare for the pressure, to actually, you know, maybe go out of their way to put themselves in pressure situations, so that they'll be the type of athlete that thrives on a close race or a close match, a tight match between you and the other person in front of you. And so what you want to do is help athletes to realize that pressure is something, usually it's something that comes from within more than out on the outside. It's something you put on yourself when you're not prepared and when you don't have faith in yourself or fear the unexpected. But you can tell your athletes that they have a choice, and you can, you know, I know from my own experience with races, I look forward to the challenge of a race to test my limits. Or you can, you know, end up cringing in front of it and being really scared. So my advice is to, when you're working with athletes, to welcome pressure and kind of help your athletes to change their attitude toward the pressure and anxiety of a competition, to look at it, you know, as an opportunity to shine and to celebrate their fitness and their sports, and that if you embrace that competition and thrive on it, you know, and get into that kind of mindset, then athletes are really, you know, they can be amazed at how successful they can be, and how successful you can be as a coach also in coaching them. So when the situation gets tight, you know, your athlete has an edge because they've already prepared for that kind of situation mentally. And they can tell themselves, you can tell your athletes there's just as much pressure on everyone else, and that your athletes know exactly how to handle it. For instance, I have an athlete right now, we'll call her Julia, who's 15 years old and had a lot of success when she was younger. And you find this with a lot of athletes that they're, you know, maybe they've had early success and they were sort of a big fish in a small pond, and then all of a sudden they're, you know, having to move up to higher levels of competition, and now they're not the top athlete anymore, and get really devastated when they find out that they can't win every race or every game like they used to. So Julia's a cross-country runner, and she won the Junior Olympics, you know, the entire Junior Olympics. She was champion and at age 9 and 10 and 11, you know, when she was younger, and also many national championships, and won the Stanford Invitational cross-country meet here, which is very prestigious. And so she had she won that last year and has a lot of success behind her. But now all of a sudden the pressure's gotten to her where there's so many expectations for her to, you know, continue that same. Of course, she should be the expected winner for the next races. But now when she goes to races, she actually gets nauseous and gets really sick to her stomach and throws up before races, or sometimes during the race, because she's so worried, and the pressure really gets to her, and that's what can happen when you're really nervous and anxious. So what I'm doing with her is working with her to be able to. Sometimes it's better to lower your expectations. Actually, not expect to win. I think it's because she was the winner the previous year. And so this time around, the Stanford Invitational Cross Country Meet is coming up again, and I'm just having her go into it more. It's actually this coming weekend, and helping her to go into it with more of an open mind, and because she's not as fit as last year, she feels, so it's just better to just go into it with an idea of that this is just one race. It's not the race. It's just one of many races. And it's a way to just kind of see where she's at in the early season, be able to just use it as a practice race. Because when you think about it, I told her every race is practice. Every event is practice. Even if it's a competition, it's basically practice for the next event. So just go into it with that kind of attitude. And just try to stay with the runners that are in front of you. Not worry about being out in front, but just get in with the pack, and then just use the person in front of you to work off their energy. And so, I having her use the magnet technique, like we've talked about, putting a magnet on the athlete in front of you, and rather than working so hard to catch up, imagine that magnet is drawing you toward that person effortlessly, so you feel their energy pulling you along, and they are doing the work rather than you. So she's finding that really helpful, and it's also, you know, it's interesting. I ask her, do you do any kind of little pep talk, a pre-race routine, or also a little pep talk to yourself before a race? And she says, actually, the last year I did that. She's forgotten to do that this time around, and so I was reminding her that really works for her, that she'd go into the bathroom, into the porta potty area, where there's, and it usually is a little mirror there, sometimes a tiny little mirror, and she'd look in the mirror, and she'd say to herself, you're a rock star. she'd say to herself, you're a rock star. F, yeah, go Julia. So it's kind of funny. That's what she would say to herself. So I It didn't mean to use any profanity on our calls, but that's exactly what she would say to get herself excited and before the race. So I said, let's use that for this next race too, and gradually your mind can start to believe that again. So she's we included that sort of pep talk, a little cheer that she says to herself before the race. As part of her like pre-race routine. So it's been working really well in the races leading up to this. And so I want to give you that kind of as an example. So sometimes it's okay to have your athletes lower their expectations for an event and just kind of go into it with an open mind and no judgment and no particular idea of what place you're going to get, but just to go with effort level, especially if they've had a lot of success in the past and then they're not getting that success right now, to, you know, not expect, you know, a really high level, just expect a high level of effort and then just, let go of the results and the outcome and just trust that the results are going to come. So she's been able to do the last race couple with that technique. She's been able to do the last couple of her races without getting nauseous, without throwing up. So her stuff, you know, she was much more relaxed in her mind, and so her body's able to relax as well. And so that happens with a lot of athletes, actually. So it's good to know that. So pressure is something that affects people in many different ways, and in fact. You know, you can ask your athletes about the different symptoms of when they're feeling that pressure, when they're feeling that anxiety. Like some of the obvious mental cues of anxiety are like lack of focus, forgetting critical details. Sometimes athletes will forget to put their number, get their race number on or their game, their competition number on that they have to have to be able to compete. Sometimes a sense of confusion and not thinking straight. They're resorting to old habits, whatever those old habits might be for each athlete, going back to the sort of the old mistakes they used to do, athletes talk about doing stupid things, not thinking through exactly what it is that they need to do. Sometimes they have inability to make decisions. But, I mean, decision-making is crucial, and when you're not relaxed, all of a sudden you make poor decisions, or just simple things like driving to an event, they make the wrong turn and end up getting there late to the race or to the event, to the game, and don't have time to warm up. So all those things are really important to consider, allow athletes, give them enough time. It's just a simple thing that a lot of people forget is to the morning of an event, if you're driving there or if their parents are driving them there, to give yourself 15 to 30 minutes cushion time to get there early so that you're have that time to not rush. Because if you're rushed, then oftentimes athletes make poor decisions and they're not able to, get ready properly. And they just resort back to, the easiest thing to do or the things that they're doing before rather than doing it, doing their skills, their warm-up the correct way. So, and rapid speech is another sign of, anxiety if speaking really fast, faster than they normally do. And then some of the physical signs of stress include, a racing heart rate, hyperventilation. Sometimes athletes will actually go into a panic mode of, where there's all these different systems working at once. Breathing is fast, the heart rate is fast. They're breathing very shallowly from the chest, so they're actually not getting enough oxygen, can actually lead to fainting sometimes. And this woman, Julie, I was talking about, would actually talk about that, having sort of a mini panic attack beforehand and really make not be able to think clearly. Some of the other physical signs include elevated blood pressure, irritability or a sense of fatigue because they're overthinking things and using way too much of their mind and body beforehand. And oftentimes athletes have muscular tension, they can have muscle twitches, especially in the neck and shoulders, and irritability. Sometimes a cotton mouth. This client Julia that I was talking about is, you know, actually experiences that throughout her races, that cotton mouth or dry mouth, because of just that happens when the whole sympathetic nervous system goes into play with fight or flight, of course, and so that can happen, and so it's really important for athletes to be hydrated, well hydrated before a race, so even if they do have that sense of cotton mouth, they can reassure themselves that, okay, I'm hydrated, I drank plenty of water, and so the cotton mouth is not a sign of dehydration, it's just a sign of anxiety, and if you take some deep breaths and can relax, then that symptom can go away, actually. And then the unsettled stomach that I mentioned before, that's a really common one. Actually, another person that had that issue was, you know, Peggy Fleming, who was an Olympic gold medalist, figure skater many years ago for the U.S. Peggy Fleming, I interviewed her, and she would actually talk about she'd get so nervous that she'd throw up right before her competitions. And, you know, she's an Olympic gold medalist, so but still got so nervous that she couldn't settle her stomach down. So it is very common. And then you've got visual distortion. Sometimes people can't even see clearly when they're nervous. You can get a flushed face, so you'll see the redness in the face, or you'll see diarrhea, needing to urinate. A lot of people have to, you know, go to the bathroom several times before a game or competition. So those are signs to ask about with your athletes or to look for. And many people have a combination of those symptoms and get nervous or scared when they get scared and they're not about not performing well, and that we've all had those symptoms at a certain time, and you know, they can lead to some people respond more with their cardiovascular system, some with their heart rate. Each person has an individual response to stress. Most of the, you know, some people do have an actual panic attack, but most of the time I think we experience a few signs at one time. And so, and sometimes people get leg cramping as well. So, so when I work with athletes before in a competition, I think I often hear those concerns about anxiety and self-doubt and difficulty relaxing as the event draws near. And it's they're often so focused on the physical elements of the race, or sometimes they're worried about who's going to be there at the game, you know, the competition, that they forget to prepare emotionally for the, you know, the real race that's inside the mind. And so when the race day actually arrives, you know, something comes up that they say weren't mentally prepared for, then it can throw their whole plan off. And so that's why you want to really help people prepare ahead of time. So beforehand, so here's my formula for preparing this sort of sequence of mental preparation. You know, ideally you want to work with somebody, if you can, say 6 weeks before a race or game, or 6 weeks or 8 weeks or 3 months would be great. The farther out, the better. That way they're often you can work with them on the other competitions leading up to their main event, let's say their championship event. Just checking in with you, too. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Yep.
Oh, okay, good. Oh, I'm good. Oh, okay, just because I am on my cell phone, I just want to make sure. So that's great. So 3 weeks before an event, you want to just, you know, have people be practicing their mental techniques as part of an ongoing training. And so, you know, giving them regular MP3s of visualizations according to what their needs are in that session. Generally, I like to do each session talking about what's coming up for them and what the issues are, and then create an audio, a visualization training based on the learning for that particular session. So if they are, let's say, like for instance, with a client, I've got one guy that's a baseball a kid that's at a local college here, and he's just having a lot of trouble with the yips. He called and he first said to me, I think I have a disease. It's called the yips. And he actually looked that up online, and he said it was a disease. I said, well, I wouldn't go so far to say it's a disease. It's not like you're going to die from it, but it's just simply a, in other words, for it's choking and, having a difficult time with an anxiety, it's that mental anxiety. And so, I talked with him about how to prepare 2 and 3 weeks in advance for that, to just prepare, imagine you're going to get the yips and then what you're going to do about that, or the that choking, and not just throwing the ball wildly rather than throwing it in the strike zone. So I'm just having him work on relaxing. And so those 2-3 weeks ahead of time, you want to build on their past successes in training. You ask them about what their successes were before and capture those feelings of fluidity and, strength and power, effortlessness. So you want to have them focus on themselves as being composed and focused and competent, and have them include in their daily visualization, simulate all the different possible things that could happen, and think about all the distractions that could come up. But, it's a good idea, I think, a good exercise to just list, have an athlete list all the different distractions that could happen, like they see another person there that they weren't expecting, a competition shows up, or let's say they get there a little bit late, how to handle that. Let's say they're not doing that well in the first quarter of a game, let's make a plan of how to handle that. So go through a kind of an if-then scenario. So if this happens, then what are you going to do? So that they have not only a plan A, which most athletes only have that one plan A, but they have a plan B and a plan C, to handle everything that could come up. So during this time, because like the night before a competition, athletes don't want to talk about failure or talk about the possibility of things going wrong. It's better to do that, say, two, three weeks before, so they can kind of practice all the different things that could happen. And then that way, the night before, they can visualize more, doing things correctly and having it go well, but still having all those other possible scenarios that they've already practiced there. So, kind of have your athletes create their own top 10 lists. Let's say all the different possibilities that could have happened in your event. Let's say in a race, you could be out in front, or you could be behind following someone else, or you could be in a pack, or you could be, past someone else and then they pass you back. So that's like 4 or 5 different scenarios right there. Or you're in front and then all of a sudden towards the end you're getting passed and you've got to respond. Or you're feeling tired during the middle of a race. Those are just all the different scenarios that could happen in a running situation. And each sport is different, of course. And, you guys can think of different things that could go wrong in the events that you're doing. And maybe each of you share something, different possible scenarios that you'd want to have your athletes practice. Dave or Michelle or Alex, do you have any ideas?
I had one where I'd done a bunch of triathlons and I was a pretty good mechanic, but not great, but I got pretty good at fixing things on my bike. But so when I'm working with some triathletes, a couple of them, when we, doing pre-race stuff and everything, we kind of have them practice just making sure that they can do basic things like put their, if their chain falls off, how to get it back on, or fix a flat when they're exhausted, or, their bike computer falls off and they freak out because they can't manage, they're relying on their bike computer to kind of pace them. So there's been times where, this is more friends type of thing, but we practice together about, in a workout, maybe doing a heavy workout in the middle, we'd have to take our tires off and, change them because we're exhausted while we're doing it, or different things like that, kind of silly things like, you know, your goggles break, you know, you look into your bag and before you're going for your swim, your goggles are broken. So, you know, how are you going to handle that if you don't have another pair of goggles and silly things like that. But with, you know, with triathletes, you know, they spend a lot of time and energy on all these little routines and, you know, it doesn't take much to throw somebody off.
Yeah, that's a great example, Dave. Yeah, I know from being a triathlete myself. And you are as well, are you? Are you a triathlete too?
I used to be. My knees aren't cooperating these days.
Uh-huh. Yeah, frustrating. But it's good you have swimming or also probably am.
Yeah.
To do, just to be able to do that. Yeah, so that's a good example. That's perfect because, you do have to, in a triathlon, it's not like the Tour de France where you've got guys coming along and just give you a new bike or do the mechanics for you. In a triathlon, you have to do it yourself. And so it is really important. I remember I was in that classic triathlon, and the Hawaii Ironman triathlon in 82 is when I got second place there overall. And then 83, I was in the race also, and somebody threw a whole bunch of tacks out there in the race. In the middle of the race, they just threw these tacks out, and all the front riders got flat tires. Oh, can you imagine? After all that training, all these guys were getting flat tires. It was just a stupid thing that someone did, and so they had to all stop. And yeah, it's like then it becomes a race who can change their tires the quickest, right? And who's done exactly what you were saying, Dave, to practice that scenario of getting a flat tire and being able to do all those little things of find out where, well, depending on what kind of tires you have, if you change the sew up, you do that, or if you've got regular tires, you got to get the tack out of there and all that. So, yeah, so just a lot to think about. And when we're tired or nervous, then that thinking, whatever it's, you go back to whatever's automatic, right, and whatever is your old habit. So if you can practice those things, so that becomes the new habit or the new normal, that you can respond well to the situation, then you'll go to that. That becomes your new way of doing it. So that's a great example. Yeah, you guys, other examples. Michelle or Alex, do you have examples of things you'd want your athletes to practice, the different scenarios?
Well, I know with cycling, Dr. Joanne, and mountain biking, there's a lot of people that are worried about crashing and hurting themselves. And in the road riding, you know, the start of the race, when you're in a pack, it can also be really intimidating because that's when people can go down when they're in those big packs and at the start and everybody's pretty jumpy. So
yeah.
I think that's a common fear and anxiety amongst, you know, mountain bikers and cyclists. I don't really have a solution though.
Yeah, when they're right at the start, you say? Yeah, people can go
down. Everybody's just really jumpy and they're not thinking straight, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So you have to be in more of a defensive mode in some way.
Yeah.
I guess, and be, you know, practice your balance, right? Because if you get knocked off balance, you can easily go down. And sometimes, you don't want to practice being in a crash because that's no fun. But
No, I think you want to position yourself on the start of the course and look at who you're surrounded by and even just assess what their energy levels are like and how, you know, what their nervous energy is like and do they look like they're good and decent riders? And if the answer is no, then I think you need to move yourself to a different position.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great idea. And if you have a choice, you know, where you are, which you do more so in mountain biking, then you can just, decide where you're going to start. Whereas something like, I know I've got this athlete, the BMX racer, and they just have eight guys go out of these gates from the top of the hill, and they don't have a choice of where they are. But they know each other's histories, like you say, and if you, it can kind of assess what's, the history of the, or the ability level of the riders around you, and then kind of make adjustments for that. If you know somebody else is like really aggressive or much more aggressive than you are, you might want to get behind that person and just it, rather than them taking a chance on them, you know, taking you down kind of thing. So that's a great example. Yeah, Michelle.
But what if, Dr. Joanne, what if you have an athlete that, say, has had multiple crashes mountain biking, and they now have, and they've had concussions and injuries and so on, and now they go into an event and they're fearful of that happening?
Yeah. That's a huge issue. And let's just repeat the question so that I can make sure I get it on recording here. So you're asking if what if an athlete has had multiple injuries or multiple concussions and they're fearful of that happening? Yeah.
Yeah, they're mountain bikers, and it's a dangerous sport generally. It's a high-risk sport. So it happens a lot. And then you can get into this fearful mindset on the starting line that this might happen again, and that's, you know, that sort of energy is going to attract, in a way, that could attract that sort of eventuality, right? If you're focused on it so much.
Yeah, exactly. So,
do you have any tricks that, you know, an athlete could use or do to sort of switch their mindset from that worry? I guess just think about the positive and seeing themselves doing it right.
Yeah, I think one kind of trick I help athletes use is just first to always have that picture in their mind, create a new movie in their mind, because they're probably replaying the mistake over and over in their minds, and then their body follows those mental instructions. So they're maybe playing over in their mind the fear of crashing, and so they're replaying a scenario of crashing or getting hurt. And so if you can have them create a new scenario, first the way to get that out of your mind, there's different ways, but I'd say if they can either blow, you know, use the, we're always breathing, right? So breathing is a great way to take in new energy with each and a new scenario, a new mindset or a new movie with your breath in, and then as you blow out, just take out, you know, breathe out the unwanted thoughts. So as they're breathing out, just have them, you know, just, you know, almost like they're blowing a ball away. I say put that thought or that that idea of crashing or getting injured, put it in imagine a ball out in front of you, like a big soccer ball, and just blow it away with your exhale, and see it getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and then it's all and then it's completely gone. So that's a way to kind of blow out that unwanted thought with the exhale. And then with your inhale, just breathe in and breathe in that new scenario or that new movie of feeling good inside and just riding really smoothly and riding with your riding with power and strength and balance. So and that, of course, it may come back again, that same thought, that fear of getting crashing. So, you know, have them take another deep breath and just blow out that thought, like you're blowing that energy out and almost kind of exhaling it out of your, well, you're out of your lungs, but you're also exhaling it out of your mind. So it's, and just say, okay, it's gone, you know, or that's history. Or now that, you know, move, and then as you breathe in, say, okay, I'm breathing in the, you know, I'm riding smoothly, I'm riding well. So it's kind of like that thought. I say, do say what you do want, don't say what you don't want. So you don't want them to say to themselves over and over, I don't want to crash, I don't want to crash, because that's reinforcing in their minds the word crash, and the right brain takes that right in. So you just, rather than saying those words, just have them, whatever that thought is in their mind that they're having, the fear of crashing, fear of injury, putting it in this ball and then blowing it away. And I actually say, now see it the size of a soccer ball, or I say it's a beach ball, and then now it's the size of a soccer ball, and now it's the size of a baseball, and now it's the size of a golf ball, and now it's completely gone. That's one way of doing it. Or you could have them put it in a balloon, like a big helium balloon, and then just and have them just let it float up into the sky, so it's just kind of absorbed by the sky, and it's gone. Just like you may notice, I don't know if you had noticed any background music, background noise. There's a guy behind me with a leaf blower that's blowing leaves, but I'm trying to get rid of, just blow away that distraction. But he'll be gone in a few minutes, a few seconds. Anyway, I just wanted to. So that's one technique, and then another one is just do something physical to change your mindset, like snap your fingers, or you know, put your hand on your thigh, or some people have a rubber band around their wrist, and they just kind of snap the rubber band, not to hurt the wrist, but just a little bit of a to wake yourself up and say, okay, that's done. Some people do, you know, just do something, you know, kind of slap your leg, do something physical to kind of wake yourself up and say, okay, I'm moving on, or letting that go, letting go of that, something that you say to yourself, or you can just say the word stop, you know, stop, and then moving forward, having something else to think about of image of riding smoothly. Does that kind of make sense? Michelle? I don't know if Michelle's still there, or she might be on mute, or she might have lost the reception because she's in Canada, but this is still on the recording here. So that hopefully that helps a little bit, too, just being able to do something to switch gears. You can also think of it, another technique I use is imagining a radio, you know, just kind of like the radio in your car, and you've got the different buttons you push to change the channel. And sometimes we're just stuck on this one channel that's, you know, the crash mode or the crash channel. And if you can tell yourself that, you know, you're just changing, you almost visually take your finger like you would on a radio and change the channel, pushing a different button there. It's like, you know, all of a sudden still listening to, you know, a bunch of unwanted advertisements on one channel. Whenever there's advertisements, I feel like that's kind of just pollution. So I just push another button and go to the music that I want, and then it's much easier to listen to. And then all of a sudden, my mind is free again, and it's you know, just a smooth sailing. So think of it like changing the channel in your mind as well. You can just flip the switch to a new channel. And sometimes you can think of it as turning down the volume, just like you would on a radio. You know, sometimes the volume is too loud on this one channel of, you know, saying I can't do this, or I'm not smart enough, I'm not good enough, I'm not fast enough, or I'm too old, I'm too fat, there's too many people watching me, all of that, and now you can just turn the volume down on that. Almost imagine yourself turning a volume knob on a radio, turning it down, and then being able to switch the channel and turn the volume up on this really positive channel of saying, hey, I can do this. This is easy. This is fun. I enjoy this. This is great. So does that kind of make sense? Alex, are you there too? Alex, do you have any ideas of things that, you know, maybe scenario, different things you want your athletes to be able to practice, or different situations?
One thing I practice with tennis players is to work on practicing. What it's like to get a call out when they think the ball went in.
What it's like to what? Sorry? Say that again?
When they hit a shot and they think the ball went in, but actually was called out.
Uh-huh.
And over time, they get emotionally derailed, and they start, they get confused, and they're emotionally stuck with on that shot. Because they're not expecting the line coach or the lineman to call the ball out. One of the things I work with them is to expect the unexpected, expect that the ball may be called out although it went in. So you have to regroup and you have to go back to either serving or return the next point. Because if they get too emotionally caught up with the last point, then they are not really ready to respond to the next point.
Right, exactly, yeah. And they have to decide if they're going to protest it or not, depending on what the rules are of that particular game.
Yeah, but sometimes, I mean, if it is not, they may have, referee, I guess, or whatever it's called.
Right.
But sometimes they're not. I mean, that could be junior players, and
they
call each other the balls in and out, and cheating happens, and they do that quite often.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I'm not referring necessarily to the playing the U.S. Open and have the eagle eye, and you can really see where the ball went in and out. That's very simple. But if you have, if you're 11 years old or 12 or 13, and you're playing against another competitor without a referee or a lineman, or, and they have to call each other's ball in or out, this very frequent cheating going on in tournaments. And so
you
have to be mentally prepared and not to be emotionally derailed if the opponent is happen to be a cheating one, and just call the ball out, although you know very, very well that it didn't, that it really the ball went in. But if you're emotionally caught up in that shot, then you're not really ready to respond to the next shot. So in tennis, it happens very, very fast. You cannot take a half an hour break and then come back. You just have to be ready in the next 30 seconds. So that's what I practice with them. Just imagine that, although you hit a great shot and it went in, according to you at least, the opponent called it out. But you have to regroup. You have to regroup. You cannot be caught up with that shot. You have to regroup. You need to come back.
Right, exactly. That's a great example, Alex, and I love that because they can get so angry and frustrated that then they, if it's a double fault, they got the two chances to serve, and the next shot they do the same thing.
That's right. Yeah. Yep.
And then they've blown it with the total serve, and they sort of.
Yep.
Making it the other person's fault.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a great thing to be able to practice. The getting a bad call from the opponent and be able to regroup. How do you tell them to regroup? Do you have a technique for that? Do you want to share, or what do you tell them to do when they're regrouped?
What I like to help them out is to understand the difference between what they can control and what they cannot
control. Right, and what they can't. I was going to say those exact words, yeah.
Right?
That's perfect,
so,
yeah.
There are quite a few things that you cannot control in this case in a tennis match. You cannot control the opponent's shot. You cannot control how the opponent calls the shot in or out. You cannot control the weather. You cannot control the referee. There are many factors you just cannot control. So you need to be aware of that.
Right, exactly.
Not prepared. Just what you were saying before, you need to be mentally prepared before stepping on the court, different scenarios, and this is one of them. And unless you are prepared, that means you're not prepared.
So
if you're not prepared, then you have to go with the emotions of the moment. Most likely, if you're not prepared, the emotions will not really necessarily help you. So if you're emotionally prepared, that scenario is one that you have already pictured in your mind as a possibility that may happen, then it will trigger some response. Once that response comes up, could be disappointment, anger, frustration. Okay, great. So then you can stay with that for a few steps, but then you have to regroup by bringing some either positive words or positive image or some breathing, something that will trigger so they can become more aware of what's happening in you at that moment.
Yeah, that's great. I love that, Alex. And I was going to suggest the same thing, is that whole idea of separating out those things you can control from those things you can't control. In tennis, and it's in golf, and
that's right.
Mountain biking and triathlons, like you said, Dave, and And
it's
so
applicable in life.
Not like, in life, yeah, exactly. In life, yeah, it's like you're, it's like in life, you know, we're expecting an email from somebody, you know, this person saying they, you know, they approve of something or they like something, and you don't get the email. Where is that darn email? You know, I can't, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
If you're expecting something and it doesn't come,
yeah,
you know, you're constantly disappointed.
Yeah,
but then you have to say to yourself, okay, well, that's their, whether they send the email or not, that's just, that's them.
Mm-hmm.
What can I control during the day? Okay, I could still focus on my work and get
mm-hmm.
things done here and
yeah,
not let my
yeah.
mind be distracted by what somebody else is going to do or not do.
Yeah,
yeah, so that is great. So I think it's great to have that conversation with your athlete, as you say, ahead of time. And make a list and go with your athlete and say, okay, let's make a list of all the things you cannot control. And also, you know, along with that, things you don't like, the
mm-hmm.
things that are
yeah,
going to go poor, might go poorly
mm-hmm.
That you cannot control. So as you say in tennis, it's like the opponent's shots, how they're feeling, whether the ball's called in or out, the weather, the sun, you know, how the sun's shining on the court, so that which controls your how you're seeing the ball and the vision. The wind really affects how you're playing. If it's really windy,
mm-hmm.
You have to make adjustments for that. All those things are out of your control. But after making that list, the athlete might start to feel depressed or thinking, oh, geez, yeah, there's so many things I can't control. But then say, let's make the list of things you can control. And that list can be even longer, much longer, actually. Things like, well, how you, the things I can't control or how I play. And then they might say, yeah, how I play. Well, that's, of course, a big category. And then you say, let's break that down into all the different things, how you play, how you do your serve. And they could break the serve down into 10, different pieces there, how you do your return, how ready you are for your returns. And they could break that down into all sorts of, just try to really diagnose all the things that they can do. And, of course, their attitude with mentally, their attitude and your effort are the huge things that you can control with your mental side. You can control how positive you are, how in your mind, whether you replay mistakes, or whether you just move forward. You can replay, of course, the three P's. You can visualize, you can have control over what you see in your mind, the visualization, the first P, positive images, and what you're seeing there. So, for instance, in your case, Alex, when that you do that first serve and it was, it was in, but the opponent calls it out, have a technique for being able to take a deep breath and just blow that anger away, or do something to manage the anger, the frustration. Some athletes go back to the walk back to the backboard and kind of play with the strings on their
mm-hmm.
their tennis racket, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or something. Some people, just have some kind of little technique. If you can do something physically, squeeze your hand together, or, ideally, the old John McEnroe, throw your racket, right?
That's right, yeah. Crush, smash it against the floor.
What's that?
Smash it against the floor.
Smash it against the floor, yeah. That, if we could do that, that would be the ultimate way to get rid of anger. He was like a little kid out there, acting like all of us, probably, that raw emotion that he's famous for, that we would all like to do. And, it was kind of good that he showed us that in a way that, it's like, okay, here's how to really get angry and get pissed off. He became famous for it, and, now he's doing all the commentating for, all the top games because he sort of made a reputation for himself, well, being a good tennis player and throwing his racket. But you know, but then other people, you got too much, of course, you can get thrown out of the game or get a bad reputation, and that's not a good way to probably show yourself anger. And if you, you know, when private, you can tell your athletes if they are in private someplace and you get really angry, yeah, go ahead and throw your racket or do something that's going to destroy any hurt yourself, but actually, you know, pound on your pillows or yell. When I've gotten angry before, sometimes I'll get on my bicycle, I'll go out and yell obscenities out into the, whoever I'm angry at on a bike out in the middle of a road where no one can hear me, or in your car where no one can hear you. Yeah, yell out your anger, and that's great, because we all need ways to get rid of our, get that frustration out. So if you can ask your athletes let's figure out a way to do that, everybody's different, to get that anger and frustration out. A way to do it when you're in private, when you can sort of express yourself more fully, and then also a way to do it when you're in public, so that you're not, you don't make a fool of yourself. Because when I'm in private, when I get home, I'm gonna go pound on my pillow or something, or write down all my frustrations, or do something. I've got a way to get that anger out later on. Then that's a good thing. Then while they're in public, in the middle of a game, you can still have a poker face and be like, Federer or somebody who's, these guys are amazing, but they don't show emotion, which is better. Because the opponent isn't seeing that, but you can still get out your frustration somehow, just saying something internally. Or what do you have suggestions, Alex? What you tell your tennis players to do to get their frustration out?
Other than the three different options that we talked about?
Yeah. Or just do they go back and do like play with a racket or? Any other things that that athletes do that are helpful?
Well, I basically teach them what you taught me.
Great.
The three P's.
Okay.
And then choose from the menu of possibilities. So whatever they feel that works better for them, then pick that one and use it. This is not about me telling them exactly what you need to do. It's practice different possibilities. We can work in the office together, and whatever either one of those three works better for you, or a combination of
either
one of them, then that's the one that works for you. So it's kind of a tailor-made. So it's kind of what I need the player, the athlete, to come to leave the decision with is, okay, now I know what I can use, what anchor I can use, so next time when I'm facing this situation, I can just grab it and this works for me. So basically, I think what you have teaching us is quite practical and useful. So I just repeat the model.
Oh, great. Well, wonderful. Great.
So whatever works for them.
You can say you can have a first P, do positive images, think of an image that works, that's of playing correctly, playing well, or the second P is power words, just saying to yourself, okay, I can do this, I can recover, move on, next. Next is a great word to use, if something didn't happen well, just go next, next play, just this, or just repeating the little phrase, just this. And then fill in the blank, just this play, just this for runners, just this next mile, just this serve, just this shot, so that you only focus on the next thing. I mean, Steve Jobs was a perfect example of that with Apple computers, when he of course he passed away, but when he was, founded Apple computers. And then he was CEO of it initially many years ago, and then he actually got fired. The whole company kicked him out of Apple, and he started this next company, a new company. What did he call it? He called it Next. mm-hmm. you know, what a perfect name for a new company. Next, like, okay, I'm not going to let that stop me. I'm going to just start my own new company. And he called it Next. And so that's a word that, or the famous line that athletes say, or that they say in business, if they say no, you say next. So if you get a rejection somewhere or something isn't working, then just instead of saying no, you say next. Next move, next shot, next thought. Because there's always more opportunities, and as soon as one door is closed, the next opportunity opens up. So yeah, that's great. Great, Alex. I really like your the example of the tennis and all too. And so, and make that list of things that they can't control in their sport, and then things that you can control. Like in Dave, are you still there too?
Yeah.
Oh, good. Yeah. Yeah, you were talking about with triathlons. Yeah, what you can't control is if you get a flat tire. If somebody throws tacks out in the street,
in the
Ironman in '83, John Howard, I think, was in the lead. You know, I talked to him afterward. He was devastated by all that. It was ridiculous. So you can't control that part. But what you can control is, how fast you can change a tire. Or get back on your bike and not let it bother you. Because that situation like that, it's going to bother everybody. So if it can have it bother you the least, and you can recover faster, then you're going to be in a lot better position. So because there's really a lot of, kind of the race within the race, right? A lot of things going on
right.
within a particular race. So it's not only who's fastest in riding when everything is going smoothly, it's who can recover faster when things go bad. So that's a whole other race going on, sort of a recovery race. So that's good. So that's fantastic, all of you sharing those examples. And so I was going to say the second P is power words, what you say to yourself, changing that from, oh, those stupid idiots that made the wrong call, a bad call, to, what can I do about this? How can I use this to my advantage? You can ask those questions. What's good about this situation? They think they're going to get me down or whatever by making a bad call with the tennis. I'm just going to move on and slam the next one, get an ace on my next serve. Use that anger. If you are angry, sometimes the anger can be one of the best things that ever happened to you, because if you can really control it and say, okay, I've got anger, but I'm going to use this anger to my advantage and go for the next shot, make this one even better, I'm going to show them, and then you can really make a comeback and be the recovery king, so to speak. And then the third P, of course, is present focus, just, being able to be right on, right here, right now, and not be in the past thinking about the mistakes that were made or the bad calls that were made or the bad luck we had, thinking we get into that woe is me, oh, poor me, I've got all this, why does this always happen to me? Kind of thing, that I get injured or something happens, and we get into that sort of the pity party, they call it. But if you can say to yourself, you get in that present focus mode of the third P, of just be right on, right here, right now, fully in the present, say, okay, what can I do right now? Then you realize, oh, I am in control. I can do something about this next shot or the next thing. And even if, say, in a race, if you start out slowly and you're not in first place, I was in 19th place when I started the marathon of the Hawaii Ironman Triathlon, and yet I said, this is a long race and a lot could happen. I just went to a place in my mind where I did feel good, which was when I won the San Francisco Marathon 2 years earlier, and I just got into this really great positive mode there and actually cooled down my body. And then, with that visualization, went from 19th place all the way up to the 15th, the 10th, to 7th place, all the way up to 2nd place by the end, by just using my head, using that visualization, and not looking at it and saying, okay, what can I control? I could say my ability to visualize and use that mental technique was a lot better than a lot of the other women out there. So I was able to, and when I saw the turnaround, where they were coming back from this turnaround point and they looked really horrible and they looked really tired, that energized me and realized I could, they're really in a poor mental space right now, so I can catch up to them. So just asking yourself, what can I use? How can I use this to my advantage? Rather than thinking of anger, like we were talking about, anger, frustration, like the bad call, Alex, that you were mentioning, rather than saying, sometimes you just get rid of the anger and then focus, but sometimes you can just say, okay, I can use this anger, use my anger to bounce back and use it as energy, as a fire, as turn that anger into fire, into desire, use what I can control to get back to change the situation around to where I'm in a winning position. So just all of that can really help. So you want to be able to use. It's a thing to be able to imagine all the different scenarios. And if you can help your athletes do that, then you're going to put them in a lot better position than the other people out there. I've got a girl who I'm working with right now is a volleyball player, and she's always got nervous with people looking at her. Different guys looking at her. You know, she's just a really 15-year-olds are really interested in how they appear to other people, and whether she's attractive to the other guys. And whenever other guys would walk in the room and watch her, she'd just totally blow it. But now we're realizing that she's she can just focus and be able to be able to use her emotions to do her absolute best. So I wanted to talk about just briefly the night before the event, what you can do. That's when the real focusing begins, about developing a pre-race or pre-event ritual or a pattern that you can carry out in the same way before each important event. So a familiar routine, reduces anxiety and, helps you feel more prepared. So some of the things you can do for pre-race or pre-game strategies is visual models, watching something. Now that everything's so available on YouTube, even if an athlete doesn't have a video of themselves doing well, if they have that, great, watch that. If they don't, then just go to YouTube and type in, if you want to do a great tennis serve or great mountain biking or great triathlon performances. And, you can just see, watch other athletes and exposure, your athletes expose your mind to athletes with good form and good training for, say, 5-10 minutes before bedtime, and then incorporate that into your mental imagery exercises. Your athlete might not be able to go as fast or as strong as, say, this, top-level Olympian or professional athlete they might be watching on YouTube, but still they've got the fluid motion, the smoothness, the strength of these other athletes they're watching. That can become programmed into your brain and muscles. And then quiet time, you want to take 10 minutes or so to do abdominal breathing, mentally rehearsing the race or the game to yourself before you go to bed. And then triggers, whenever, like you said, to Alex, with the bad call kind of stuff, when something's a trigger for anxiety, you want to turn it into a signal for something positive, for aggressive or for relaxation, just letting it go, whatever it is that works for you. So turn whatever it is that gives you anxiety, be able to turn it around, switch the channel. Think of switching that radio channel to something that works. Another thing that you want to encourage your athletes to do is distractions. You know, just if they're really nervous before an event, watch a light comedy, an inspirational movie or something. Go to YouTube or watch a DVD or something that's funny. Just even on YouTube, you can just put it on, search on, stand-up comedians and get without watching a whole movie, just watch 5 minutes of somebody, Robin Williams or somebody who just, passed away recently, watch some of his funny stuff. Joan Rivers, a great comedian who just passed away recently, she just told, I was just listening to some of her recent, she was just up here in the San Francisco Bay Area at the Mountain Winery performing just a month before she died. Amazing. I mean, she was just here a few weeks ago, and then she, passed away. And she was a really funny comedian, though. I mean, she would just laugh about herself. It's one of her jokes she would say to herself was, my thighs are so big they could feed a family of 18 for a year. And, it was hilarious. She would just laugh about herself and make funny jokes. So if you can, it's funny, it's amazing. If you can encourage your athletes to laugh a little bit before, the night before their event, it just kind of takes the pressure off and just lightens things up. And they realize, hey, this is not a life or death situation. I'm going to be able to go on no matter what. And the same thing the morning of the event, to be able to laugh a little bit too. And then another thing you can do is, remember, eating smart is really important. Sometimes people are in a foreign place or a different place. They want to eat, try out something new. But try to have your athletes maintain a regular eating program. Eat foods that work for you. Eat at a scheduled time before your event that you're used to. Don't experiment with new exotic spicy foods or anything. And then the right clothes, if you have a choice, like in triathlons or if you can wear the clothes that you wore when you had your best event or workout, that's really good. Sometimes that can just give you, it's not superstition, it's more just a feeling of familiarity. Wear what makes you feel comfortable and successful gives you that winning feeling. Some people wear the same shoes that they've always worn for, when they did well. So just that wear things that help you feel good about yourself. And then your environment's really important before an event. Just, you don't want to be around really negative people or people that are going to just put you down. Or if you do have a coach that is just really harping on you kind of thing, if you can encourage athletes to, they still have to deal with that coach, but to not – not let it bother you. Just try to be around people that are positive, that give you good influence. Or just being alone is okay too, and just reading and doing what makes you feel at ease. And try to control your environment a bit so that you're not, if possible. And then just have a pre-race or pre-game checklist. Arrange for everything ahead of time. Just if you can be organized and make sure you got the right travel time, setting your alarm right, developing a list of things to bring and do, and bringing that your race number, your game number, the sports drink that you're used to, pack your water. Just little things like if you're driving to a race, make sure your gas tank's filled up beforehand. Bring the correct race shoes, the socks, just simple things like, little details like that, the right socks that you feel comfortable with that don't give you blisters. Those kind of things just help if you've got all that set up ahead of time, the pre-race, your pre-race clothing, your during-race clothing, your post-race clothing, so you've got all that set out, so plenty of fluids and, sports bars, fruit for afterwards. Just have all that kind of set up ahead of time and have that checklist if you have it actually written down on something. That helps a lot. And then nervous, just dealing with that nervousness part, that it's okay to be nervous. It's and just remind your athletes that nervousness is, probably unavoidable because it's always there, but it can actually contribute to your best performance. Use it as an ally rather than as something to be afraid of. It's okay. It's normal, natural to be nervous before an important event. And say to yourself, okay, these the pre-race jitters, or that's an indication I'm really psyched up and ready to go. So just to say, yeah, I'm glad I'm nervous. Welcome it. Just say, bring it on, you know. And whoever's there at the race, rather than being nervous of them or worried, just say, hey, bring it on. So then just the right energy, kind of using, do whatever helps you feel good. Bring your music that includes your, tell your athletes to make sure they bring the MP3s that you've created for them. Remind them if they can make a playlist of all the visualizations you've created for them. Maybe you want to do at least three, like one for the three P's, one for positive images, so you're imagining the different scenarios, and the a good race, one for the second P for power words, you know, those positive affirmations, and make a third one for present focus, for how to be, how to relax and, you know, execute in the situation. That would be great, and have them put that on a playlist on their iPod or their iPhone or whatever device they have. And then, and they can also have a music playlist, so they can be able to, listen to that, you know, the night before the race. They could be listening to both, yeah, encourage them to listen to their favorite music and your visualizations. Whatever helps them to feel good, to achieve an emotional, physical high. Some people like to burn sage or, you know, some incense that makes them relax or do some meditation. You know, you want to help them avoid activities that's likely to make you tired or upset or sad or depressed or negative. So, you know, a lot of times, like someone's tapering for a marathon, you know, for a week or two before, they're doing less and less physical activity, but they're thinking, oh, okay, well, I'm doing less, so I can clean my house and remodel my house. But they're doing other things that make them feel, that could tire them out. So you want to do things that are not going to make you feel excessively tired. And you want to avoid personal conflicts if possible, and avoid a high workload. So those are the things before the race, and then during the race morning, the primary concern is just during that important phase is just to quiet your mind and to regulate the flow of adrenaline so you can achieve that really good flow of arousal. So, you know, and athletes are really individualized about that, so you want to ask them what worked in the past. And not just do what works for other people, but find out what works for them and keep a logbook of that so they learn. It becomes a learning experience as you go along. So you can be learning. You want to keep your own kind of logbook or your own charts of that athlete. And as you work with them over the sessions, what's going to work well for them, what is working, what's not working, so you can remind them of that and sort of refine the list as you go along. So just help them to find their right level of energy and keep a detailed post-race log for each race to find out what emotional state works for them. So things like, you know, what you want to do the morning of the race is use music if that helps them, or play your MP3s and just, you know, being able to think about their arousal or energy adjustment. So if you're too anxious, you know, do the deep breathing. If you're too unmotivated, maybe do, you know, jump up and down a few times, take a clench your fists, do some quick movements, dance to music. So some people are not energized enough. Some people are too nervous. So find ways to either bring down the level or bring up the level. Excuse me. And then you want to quiet your mind before a warm-up. You know, you do a physical warm-up, but then encourage your athletes to do a mental warm-up as well. Maybe they want to do kind of a mental warm-up as you're driving. If someone else is driving into the race, they could be listening to your MP3 while you're driving, while someone else is driving, or you could listen to it in the car if it's not too relaxing. Of course, you don't want them to close their eyes if they're doing the driving. But, you know, just getting ready that way, and then they're doing the physical warm-up. And then right before the event, maybe doing another mental warm-up. So it might be like a triathlon almost, a mental warm-up, physical warm-up, mental warm-up. So you breathe deeply, calm their minds, remind themselves how well-prepared they are. Say to yourself, you know, I've done this 1,000 times before. I'm fully trained. I'm well-rested. I'm ready to do well. I can perform well under these situations. And just encourage them to follow their pre-race routine, to not try anything new, carefully just attend to the last minute details they need to do, and it's just just routine kind of stuff, develop that race, that routine that works for them. And then, as I was mentioning before, to lighten up, just think of something funny if you can beforehand, tell a funny joke, be around somebody that's fun, take your mind off the race for a few minutes. You could do that if you can think of something, remind yourself this is just another game, another race. It's not a life or death situation. And then, say 30 seconds before the starting of it, I would encourage them to do like a centering technique. Just take 10, a few deep breaths to relax, breathe in through your nose, focus on your center, and then just breathe out through your mouth and relax. And just imagine those, unwanted thoughts going out through your fingertips and toes. You want it to, get more oxygen to the brain and to the body, and then improve mental clarity and increase oxygen to the supply, to supply the muscles. So that's the race morning. And then, anyone have questions so far, or thoughts about that, or comments?
But I have to go, Dr. Chua. I'm sorry, but I guess we...
Okay. Yeah, I know. It's the 10:30. Yeah. So we'll just... that's great. And we'll talk about the, during the race, maybe next time, too, which will be...
Okay.
It'll be the second and fourth Thursday of the month, so second Thursday in October. That'll be great. And thank you, Alex, for joining us. And Dave and Michelle, are you still there?
I'm here.
I have a quick question for Alex, if he's still there. Oh, he's gone.
Oh, shoot.
Do you remember that book he told us about, Dr. Joanne, the first, second, third, or first, second, learn, or something? Do you remember that book?
Yeah, I don't have it with. I don't have that title with me right now. I'll look back at my notes here. If I could find it here, I could just email it to you. Yeah.
I can Facebook him, too. Sorry I lost you earlier. My computer froze, and I had to reboot it.
Oh, that's okay. That happens for sure.
Yeah.
I know. Dave, did you have a question about marketing or other things you wanted to ask, too?
Yeah, if you had, I'm shifting my clinical psych practice to more of this, like performance psychology, but haven't really done much marketing, none in this field. And I'm just trying to send, as far as, I kind of have some documents I'm putting together, like some advertising things and stuff like that. When it comes down to, fees and everything, I've got it down with my clinical work. That comes out easy these days. But as far as, recommendations on how do you set your fees, or how, because I really don't have many other people around here that I can, that are basically wanting to talk about this, it's kind of this odd thing. So I was curious, is there any, benchmark of sorts of how you set fees, like if you're going to do there's a lot of travel baseball teams here. I'm kind of connected with them, so I've been holding off, what would be a reasonable expense to, do I charge a team per meeting, or do I set up kind of like a coaching plan where I'm available for 3 months and this is what I offer and this is what I should pay or charge, or like for individual, or you buy like a group session kind of thing, a package kind of thing. Where any suggestions on the basics of that?
Yeah, actually, we should. I can give you some ideas right now, and then since you asked that, maybe we could do our next session, our next call, just on that topic on fees. That would be great. For next the second week and second Thursday in October, we could just plan on talking about that, setting fees and how to do packages and that kind of thing. But what I could start with is, I think it's best to start work with individuals. That's the easiest, if you can get any, if you can work with individuals, of course, that's most similar to your general clinical practice, right? I think a general rule of thumb is to start, when you're first starting to get clients there, is to start lower, you know, lower fee, and then gradually raise your fee. And if there's no resistance, then you can continue to raise fees over time, your fee for new clients. And if you have old clients that were at the older fee, I usually just keep them on the older, the earlier fee structure if they're longer term, since they've been with me a while. But I, for instance, just the good news is that there's not that many people doing this kind of work, I don't think, and so you're really unique. And I found I'm in the San Francisco Bay Area here, and people have tried. You think San Francisco Bay Area should have tons of, you know, sports psychologists, but there people call and say they're you know, they have trouble finding someone like me. And so that's a good thing. When there's a scarcity, you know, you can generally charge more. I find it, I'm a real entrepreneur myself, and I think if you can think of yourself as an entrepreneur in that, you know, it's sort of the market, what people will, you sort of charge what the market will bear, that there's no limits on what you can charge. But it's better to start lower and then gradually raise your fees over time. You can either, in terms of a structure, you get charged by the hour or by the month. I generally charge more for the first session. So, for instance, for me, if someone's just doing a single session, sometimes they want to just do a, you know, try me out kind of thing, I charge like $250 for a first session, and I'll go for a longer period of time, an hour and a half, an hour and 15 minutes to an hour and a half to get, and then I tell them that includes an assessment, you know, full assessment of what their situation is, and it includes, you know, the actual coaching and giving them suggestions, problem solving, and then I also include the MP3, doing an audio. I do that, make sure I do that in the first session. Some people think, you know, will wait to do any kind of treatment stuff to the second session, but I think it's really important to do that in the first session, give them something, a tool that they can take home with them, and that really helps them to continue on as a client, because that first session they're really trying to decide, you know, if they want to work with you, and if you're going to give them something. They don't want to just do a, you know, assessment only and then go walk away saying, feeling like, oh, I didn't really get anything. So you're doing a lot of work in that first session. You know, you're doing that course assessment, and you're doing marketing for yourself to, you know, kind of sell your services, so you're continuing on, and then you to be able to continue with them, and then you're also doing this visualization, so it's a lot that's going on. So I think it's worth charging more for that. And then in terms of the individual sessions ongoing after that, I used to, when I first was starting out, I charged $75 a session, and then after over time, you know, I got more clients. I raised it to $95 a session, and then I raised it to you know, 100 and 125, and then up to 150 a session, and that was fine for you know, people were willing to pay that. But I think generally, what they're willing to pay you for yours as a clinical psychologist, whatever you were charging for that, you should be able to charge that, at least that, for your performance psychology too. Did you have a certain fee structure for your clinical psychology, an hourly rate you were charging?
Generally, it's about $150.
Uh-huh. Yeah, okay, so you could do that for performance psychology as well. And then I found that if I just go ahead and have them do a charge by the month, four sessions or a month, whichever comes first, and have them pay for that, then that seemed to work better, because I get a better commitment from the clients. So I would charge. So I started charging, you know, $600 for a month, which included the four sessions. And then I was doing okay with that. So then I raised it to $795 per month, which comes out to basically $200 per session. So I was doing that for a while, and now I'm charging $995 per month. So that comes up to $250 per session. So that's what I'm charging here, and that's I think you can kind of progress upward in that same fashion. And if you get resistance, if people aren't willing to pay that, then you come down a bit. But the good news is that it's you can basically charge whatever you want and whatever the market will bear. If you have a in terms of team, so that's the individual kind of rate. And if someone's just doing a first session only, then they're only willing to commit to that first one. I think it's worth charging more for a first session.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got somebody that's that's really a top name, an Olympic athlete or a professional athlete, sometimes I'll do one or two sessions for free with them, or work with them for complimentary, in order to get that experience and that kind of testimonial from them is really valuable for your credibility to be able to get more athletes. So that's how I charge for individuals, and then with teams, it's I don't know if you've ever done any professional speaking, have you, or any speaking for groups?
Yeah, I've done a bit of that.
Do you have a certain fee that you charge for speaking, or just complimentary?
It's always been complimentary because of my work. So I know speakers that I've hired, can be all over the place, from $500 an hour to $2,000 for half a day. We hired someone who did an 8 hour, a very notable person in the psychology field, and his 8 hours was $5,000. So it was for a conference. But,
for 8 hours it was $5,000. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that kind of thing, it just depends on the budget, that the group has. If it's a
I was thinking baseball, there's these club teams, they call them, where they're very popular in Arizona, California, and as far as their very competitive baseball teams, they also have them for volleyball, and the parents are putting out quite a bit for just monthly fees to be on the team. Like a family might be paying anywhere from $100 to $300 a month just to have their kid on this team. And that doesn't include any of their other expenses. So I've talked to several coaches who, kind of said, well, what would it take for us to, what would it cost? And my first thing was just thinking about doing more of a first session presentation to the team for free. And then, if they set up some kind of thing, maybe get some individual clients from that, or, if the team insists on, we want to do this as a team, what kind of cost I would be looking at to do that. So,
yeah, I think that's a great way to go to start with, because they need to get some experience with you before hiring you as a team coach or team, performance psychologist kind of thing. And so if you can, give one talk for free there, like you say, and then get individual client, give a special offer for, let's say, a reduced fee for, I've done, say it's $297, I'll do a special for $297 for three sessions, three introductory sessions kind of thing. Give that kind of special offer at the during and at the end of the talk. So they're basically paying $100 per session. $297 is you know, just psychologically is better than to the minds of 300, as you know, just the sort of the retail model. And so, and the number seven seems to always appeal to people. People always buy things with the number seven in it, so it's better to be 297 than 299. Just a kind of a subconscious kind of thing that you may know. So, if you can do that, make an offer to, and work with a few clients that way on the team, then they'll get to know you, and then you could make a proposal for working with a team and use those same kinds of figures that you were mentioning before. Yeah, for working with a group. That was for professional speakers, did you say? Of the 500 an hour? Yeah, 2,000.
Yeah, because when I've done groups, I mean, you're doing a lot more work. So I'll charge more in that way. So just kind of, because I have to be better prepared. I have to have more materials ready for people and all that stuff.
Exactly, yeah. It's a lot more work, yeah, and but you can think of it as once you get those materials prepared, then you can use them over and over again with different teams.
Right.
So more work up front, but I think it's really, it just depends on the budget of that particular club, and so they have different budgets often. You know, if you just ask them, if they have a budget for speakers, they might say, oh, no, we don't have a budget for that. But if they have a budget, you ask them, do they have a training budget or an educational budget or consulting? You know, they may have different budgets for these different things. Then they've all got all kinds of money for those sort of things. Or educational materials, you know, if you have a book, articles, that sort of thing. Sometimes they might not be able to pay you for the speaking per se or coaching, but they can pay. They have a budget for educational material, so they can buy your books or your articles. You could create a little, handout or a kind of a little guidebook, workbook type thing, just by putting together, copying off. A few pages for each person and call it a workbook, and then you can charge a certain amount for those. A lot, you can charge a lot for those, and then do the speaking or the coaching for free or for a lower fee, but they're basically paying for your coaching with the educational materials, because it's like a physical product that they're paying for. So that's another way to go too. So, those are great questions. Is that helpful for you?
Yeah, very much. I appreciate it.
Yeah, so that's just kind of the beginning of that. And why don't we, since you asked that question, next time for our next call, which is, I don't have my calendar in front of me, second Thursday of the month. Does anyone have a calendar in front of them?
October 9th.
October 9th, yeah. So we do our call then. We can talk more, make that our topic, their fees and how to work with groups and how to charge and that kind of thing. And also negotiating, it's a huge area. How to negotiate your fees.
Mm-hmm.
How to sell, give that, because it's all about, providing value and being able to find, prove to them that you are worth the higher fees that you can charge kind of thing. So, it's great. It's a great topic. So thanks. Thanks, Dave. And thanks, everyone, for a great discussion today. We'll look forward to talking with you then. Was there certain things, anything that was stuck out in your mind? Maybe anyone that's still on the call here can, things that were helpful for you today, a particular nuggets that you got from the call, so we can sort of reinforce that for others?
Oh, the 3 P's is real helpful to me.
Okay.
That was real helpful.
Okay, great. Yeah. So as your athletes get nervous before the race, they always got to do the 3 P's, go to the bathroom 3 times, huh?
Yeah.
Just making a joke. Yeah. I don't know if, Michelle, are you still there too? I think she, because she's okay. In Canada, she might have had a... go to, and we're kind of over time here. So, I think on a marathon call here, one of my longest calls.
Well, thanks for your time.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I always love talking with you. And I love being helpful, and it's just an honor to have these calls and to serve you, and to for us to have great discussions. So great. All right, thanks so much, and we'll talk to you on October 9th then.
Well, thanks very much. Happy birthday.
Have a great day, everyone. Okay, thanks, Dave.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now.